It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the new Sand Valley Golf Course in the town of Rome is joining a group of highly acclaimed courses around Wisconsin. We'll talk about how the state ranks as a destination for golf tourists and whether the golf industry is set up for success down the road. First, Foxconn is expanding its operations now to western Wisconsin. The company announced today that it's opening an innovation hub in downtown Eau Claire. That comes less than 3 weeks after Foxconn said it would open a similar hub in downtown Green Bay. Ground was officially broken in June on the 20 million square foot facility in Racine County. Foxconn also purchased a building in downtown Milwaukee to be its North American headquarters. Governor Walker says the Green Bay and Eau Claire sites are examples of the Foxconn bonus. Rich Kramer is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Rich, start us off with the basics on what we're hearing for Foxconn's plans in Eau Claire.
So they're purchasing two properties. One is a building, they're both in downtown. One is a building known as the Grant Building, or the Grand Building. I wasn't familiar with this building, but I guess it's kind of a local historical landmark of sorts. And then the other building or property that they're purchasing is in what's called Haymarket Landing. That is actually part of the Confluence project that's been in the works for 5 years plus now. So it's a mixed-use building that at the top of the building has some student housing, and then they're going to basically take over the main floor, it sounds like.
And these are being called innovation hubs. Do we know what's going to happen there?
Yes. It was all fairly vague, the announcement, but the best I can tell, and after follow-up questions, it's going to be a two-part operation. So one part will be a tech startup, kind of a business incubator. So the idea is to attract local people who are tech savvy to come up with business ideas that could possibly partner with Foxconn. Foxconn also says that they can just do their own thing. They can just focus on entrepreneurship and use that as a launching point that is not necessarily tied to Foxconn. The other is an innovation center, which will basically be research and development for software and applications that would assist Foxconn products.
And in a news release, UW-Eau Claire said having Foxconn in town would be good for the company and the university itself. Why is that?
Well, because they've got a lot of young people who want jobs, and the hope is that they'll be able to get high-paying jobs in Foxconn and not necessarily have to leave the city. That's the incentive with them having a research and development facility right in Eau Claire. And it'll be located very closely to what is a company known as Jamf Software that is a local homegrown kind of a tech startup that's done quite well.
And Governor Walker was at this morning's announcement. What did he have to say?
Well, he said that this is more proof that the Foxconn project isn't just southwestern Wisconsin. It's not just going to benefit that corner of the state. So he also mentioned the investments that Foxconn made in Milwaukee, the recent development of the announcement about the technology hub in Green Bay. He said this is just more of that. And in fact, I asked the Foxconn representative who was there. It was Alan Young, who is the director for U.S. Strategic Initiatives. I said, is this going to be the latest, is this the end of it, of the investments? And he said, we don't know yet, but he did say cryptically, I think we're just starting.
And state Democrats have been, many of them, skeptical of the Foxconn project, especially the state's incentives, billions of dollars in incentives for this company. Any reaction to this Eau Claire Innovation Hub from Democrats yet?
Well, actually, this announcement happened during the time I normally would be hosting a candidate forum leading up to the Democratic primary for the 31st State Senate District, which is being vacated by Kathleen Vinehut as she runs for governor. So Democrats on that program were alluding to the fact that this could be, first of all, that it's a tremendous amount of money that's going to a foreign-owned company, and there's a lot of skepticism about whether there will be the payback that the governor has promised and the company has promised. Also, I spoke to a protester at the event, a small group of protesters just outside of where the announcement was made, and this person said that he was concerned that the Foxconn would be drawing some of the young talented people that we need in our local economy to the southeast corner of the state. So on top of the environmental concerns, the amount of tax dollars that are going to this company, there's also at least concern among some people that this might just kind of vacuum up all the young talent that could otherwise stay in this region.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter in Eau Claire, about an announcement from the company Foxconn about their plans for Eau Claire, an investment in what they're calling innovation hubs in Eau Claire, in the western part of the state. And Rich, we've seen polls, the Marquette Law School survey, suggesting that people who are outside of that southeastern Wisconsin area where the big Foxconn plant is, skeptical that this is going to help them in their part of the state. Have you been hearing things like that as this develops in the Eau Claire area?
Well, I've certainly heard that from Democratic candidates who are hoping to run or hoping to win statewide office. Also, just looking at some of the social media comments on Facebook and Twitter, there's definitely skepticism that this will do much for places outside of Racine and Mount Pleasant. So, you know, whether that bears out, we'll have to wait and see.
Do we have any idea of the timeline for this Eau Claire Innovation Hub, when it's expected to be up and running?
Yes. Alan Young of Foxconn said that they're still working on acquiring the properties, that they expect to be finished by the end of 2018. They hope to be operational at the Innovation Center and at the Business Incubator by early 2019.
Rich, I wonder if you can put this into some context for us. You mentioned that software company that's made a big splash, homegrown in Eau Claire. Can you talk for the rest of the state outside of Eau Claire? Give us the economic scene in Eau Claire as this innovation hub is being proposed.
Well, this is just the latest in a long series of announcements that Eau Claire is growing, especially the downtown. It's really been remarkable to see what's happening. A lot of people try to point to this performance arts space and mixed-use facility known as the Confluence as kind of spurring that, and certainly that did have some direct investments, as there were two hotels that were redeveloped that had been abandoned. But there's just been a ton of activity in downtown Eau Claire. And, you know, a lot of people credit the artistic community or the artistic economy for that. And I think that's certainly part of it.
I know we talked to you, Rich, about legal challenges to some of the funding for the Confluence project. Is that all in the past now?
Yeah. The Supreme Court did. There's a small portion of a Supreme Court case recently, a state Supreme Court, that could be revisited by the local circuit court here in Eau Claire County. But basically, that's wrapped up. It would take a lot of wrangling for that to be stopped at this point. And that surrounded around what are known as TIF districts, tax incremental financing districts.
And getting back to the Foxconn Innovation Hubs, Rich, the 150 jobs, I think, was the number you mentioned. Is there a hope among supporters that this spins off? It's not just those jobs, that this would spin off into other jobs in the Eau Claire area.
Well, this Foxconn official, Alan Young, did allude, kind of hinted that there could be more growth. Governor Walker hinted that there could be more growth in this area. They've also talked about just the jobs that will be required to retrofit these buildings or these spaces. So there's going to be some spillover construction jobs from that as well.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio reporter in Eau Claire. We talked with him about Foxconn's announcement of plans for a new innovation center in Eau Claire. You can join in with your thoughts about what's going on with Foxconn around the state, the main project in Racine County, and as we've heard, developments in Milwaukee, Green Bay, and now Eau Claire. Are you optimistic about the impact this might have on the state? Are you worried about the amount of money that the state is putting into it? You can email us ideas@WPR.org or share your thoughts on Twitter. Tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Right now, golf season is in full swing, and whether someone's flying in from out of state or just driving down the road from their house, Wisconsin's reputation as a golf destination seems to be growing. Golf Digest currently includes 8 Wisconsin courses on its list of the top 100 public courses in the country, and 2 of those cracked the top 10. That got us wondering, could Wisconsin be considered the nation's golf capital quite yet? Gary D'Amato is a sports columnist for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He talked with Central Time producer Dean Kinetter earlier today.
So in the last 20 years or so, we've seen a handful of courses in Wisconsin that get talked about with some of the country's best: Whistling Straits, Black Wolf Run, Erin Hills. But let's look at the new kid on the block, Sand Valley. Just opened up for its second year in the town of Rome. Can you tell us what this course is like and why it's getting rave reviews?
Yeah, it's actually two courses now. Well, two and a half if you want to count the par three course called the Sandbox. And the original Sand Valley course opened to the public last year. This year, the second course, designed by David McClay Kidd, called Mammoth Dunes, opened in May. And they also, Ben Crenshaw and Bill Coore did a course called the Sandbox, a 17-hole kind of unorthodox par three course. That's spectacular. And the reason, you know, I've written quite a few glowing stories about these golf courses, and the reason I think so highly of them is these are the same guys, the Kaiser family, that built Bandon Dunes, one probably the most acclaimed golf resort in the world out on the Oregon coast. And they're doing a very similar thing, same formula in central Wisconsin, middle of nowhere, sort of in this, they built on this prehistoric, there was a prehistoric lake there that when it broke its dam, the water spilled out tens of thousands of years ago and left behind this giant sand deposits. So as anyone who follows golf knows, the best topography or the best soil conditions for golf courses are sand-based. And so they were able to build these really linksy, bouncy, firm, fast, fescue courses. Spectacular scenery. You feel like you're in Montana when you're on these places. And it's just a total golf experience from the moment you pull in the parking lot until you leave, whether you stay and play one course or two or all three, stay at the lodging there. It's just it's an amazing experience playing golf there.
And you recently wrote about the impact that Sand Valley is having on the area economically and environmentally, too. What's happening there?
Yeah, you know, the Kaiser family, a lot of people who build golf courses pay lip service to the taking care of the environment and being good stewards of the land, but these guys really mean it. They bought, in addition to buying 1,700 acres that they're going to devote to multiple golf courses, and I think more are on the way besides the three they already have, they purchased some 7,200 additional acres, and they are stripping all the pulp red pines off this land. The pines were planted there by the paper mills for pulp, and it's basically a monoculture. It's an agriculture. It's a crop, basically, of pines that are planted in rows, and the Kaisers are stripping thousands of these trees off this 7,200 acres, and they're going to restore it to the native habitat, what nature intended it to be. Just a sand barren with sort of these oak savannas, just beautiful rolling countryside. They're going to open a recreation park where people can bird watch or fat tire bike or primitive camp. But there won't be any, very few signs of civilization on this land. So I really like what they're doing for the environment. And then, not to be understated, is what it's done for the economy in the town of Rome, Wisconsin Rapids nearby, and the whole Adams County, which has been horribly depressed since the paper mills have been going out of business. So it's a win-win-win, I think, all the way around.
And Sand Valley is joining a group of really highly acclaimed courses in Wisconsin. Given what we have here in the state, in terms of golf tourist destinations, how do you think we stack up?
You know, I think we stack up with just about any state or any region in the country right now. With the courses you mentioned, Whistling Straits and Black Wolf Run, the Kohler Company courses, Erin Hills, Century World, Lasonia, and all the great courses in Lake Geneva, and now Sand Valley coming on board. There are very few places in the country you can go and have 8 or 10 world-class golf courses within basically a 2 to 2.5 hour drive of each other. So I think Wisconsin stacks up now as, definitely in the top 2 or 3 states in the nation for the number of great public accessible golf courses.
We're talking with Gary D'Amato right now, sports columnist for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, looking at where Wisconsin stands in the world of golf and golf tourism. And Gary, anyone who's lived in Wisconsin in January could rightly think that our reputation in the golf world is a bit surprising. So why Wisconsin? What's allowed us to become such a hot spot?
You know, I think there are a number of factors that go into that. I think Herbert V. Kohler Jr.'s vision when he built Black Wolf Run and opened back in 1988, I think showed that golf could be a destination in Wisconsin. And since then, he's obviously added three more courses and is going to be adding a fifth when all the approvals go through with the DNR and the Army Corps and all that, when he gets all the red tape taken care of there. And I think that showed that what Wisconsin could be in terms of golf. We do have a winter, of course, but we also have pretty good weather from May through October and great conditions for growing bent grass, which is the preferred surface at most golf courses. I don't think there are better greens in the country than Wisconsin's bent grass greens.
Wow.
In June, July, and August. I think they're superior to anything you'll find anywhere. And, the number of good courses and also the number of major championships that have been here that have sort of put Wisconsin on the map, I think gets people to want to come here.
Yeah, those tournaments, they haven't been held at Sand Valley yet, but other courses have held major tournaments in men's and women's golf. How important is that to putting us on the map and getting people to come play here?
I think it's huge because there's a certain segment of the golf population nationwide and worldwide. There are a lot of people out there with disposable income, and there are a lot of people who love to play courses that the pros play on. And so these people are flocking. They're flying their private jets in. They're getting together their corporate buddies and the people who maybe aren't in the upper echelon as far as income are saving their money and for buddies' trips and coming here to play golf because they see Jason Day winning at Whistling Straits. They see the two U.S. Women's Opens that have been at Black Wolf Run, Sayri Pak basically launching the Korean golf boom back when she won the 1998 U.S. Women's Open.
Mm-hmm.
And people see these things, and they want to come here and play those golf courses, I think.
The top-ranked courses that we're talking about here in Wisconsin are public courses, but as you mentioned, they're really expensive and not always in the budget for most of us. For those of us who do love golf but aren't going to be playing at the Straits or Sand Valley, is Wisconsin still a good place to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I get that one a lot from people, especially when I write about Whistling Straits or Erin Hills or Sand Valley, and people say, yeah, okay, they're good courses, but we can't afford to play them, or we can play them once a year maybe. My answer is always to that is always, you know, I can't afford the best sports car or eat at the best restaurants in town, but it doesn't mean I don't want them to be there and that other people should enjoy them because there's lots of restaurants I can eat at and there's lots of cars I can't afford. Well, a few cars anyway. But I mean, the point is there are almost 500 golf courses in Wisconsin. Roughly 400 of them are public. And out of those 400, 350 are affordable. So if you can't afford a Whistling Straits or an Erin Hills, you certainly can afford to play fine golf courses throughout the state for, you know, one-tenth of that cost.
And do you think there's any really good ones out there sort of flying under the radar that might be a bit of a bargain?
You know, there's a great course called Lasonia Links in the middle of the state, in the southern part of the state, near Ripon, near Green Lake. And Lasonia is a very affordable, what I would consider to be a very, very high-level golf course designed by Langford and Moreau, two great golf course architects in the 30s and 40s, and just really dramatic topography and a fun golf course to play. That would probably be number one on my list of hidden gems, but there's lots more.
Yeah, I played the Woodlands course at Lasonia, and I got to say, it was gorgeous, a lot of fun. The new golf course development that we're seeing in Wisconsin today, is that focused on those high-end resort-type courses?
Right now it is, because the model, you know, Herb Kohler and Mike Kaiser sort of set the model. Bob Lang built Erin Hills, and those are the courses that are getting play. The courses that are in that price point we're talking about, $200 to $400 for a round of golf, it's a lot of money. But those courses are doing very, very well. The courses that charge $20 for a round of golf also are doing very well. What I worry about are the golf courses in that $40 to $70 range.
Hmm.
I think those are the golf courses that aren't getting a lot of play because people, who can't afford to play golf are playing the other courses that I talked about, the $20 to $30 courses, and the wealthy people are coming to play the other courses. So those courses stuck in the middle, I think, would be the ones that might be struggling right now.
And as we start to wrap up, looking 20, 30 years down the road, do you think the golf industry in Wisconsin is on a sustainable path? Will it maintain that reputation?
I think it will. Mike Kaiser is planning on building possibly 2 to 3 more courses, so there will be 5 or 6 golf courses at Santa Valley. Herb Kohler wants to build a fifth course, and probably will on land just south of, on the lake, just south of Sheboygan. So there are going to be more, great courses coming online. And we've got a population that of people who really love golf in Wisconsin. I think Wisconsin always ranks number one or two in the nation in golfers per capita. We're right up there with Minnesota. And so I think those things bode well for the future.
And Gary, before we let you go, I've got one more thing. Where are you headed for your next round?
You know, I just played Morningstar, which is a fine golf course in Waukesha County. And I don't know where I'm playing next, but I'll tee it up on any golf course in Wisconsin. It doesn't matter to me.
All right. Well, wherever it ends up being, hit them straight. And thanks for joining us today. Appreciate the time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Gary D'Amato is a sports columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked with Central Time producer Dean Knetter about the state of the golf industry here in Wisconsin and the national attention golfing in the state is getting. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. First, to the music we just started this segment with brought back memories. This might also ring some bells.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
Soap operas have been part of the U.S. culture and entertainment landscape for decades, first appearing on the radio, then making the transition to the newfangled medium, television. They blaze trails in how stories were told and by whom, and their style has influenced how programs are shaped not only on network and cable TV, but on streaming services like Hulu, Netflix, and Amazon. Elena Levine is a professor and director of graduate studies and the Media Studies MA in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at the UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of a forthcoming book about daytime soaps and their influence on American culture. Elena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, take us to the primordial days of the soap opera. How did they get started?
Well, soap operas began in radio. They're one of the earliest narrative entertainment genres in American broadcasting. They started really in the early 1930s as a form of continuing story on daytime radio, where episodes would continue from day to day, usually just 15 minutes long each day. And they were sponsored by soap advertisers, laundry soap, dish soap, that sort of thing, who were trying to reach housewives and advertise their products to them. And so they would have an advertising message, they would tell the story, and then have the advertising message again before the show was over. So that's partly how they got their name and how the genre got established.
Now, it's one thing to make a commitment to listen to something in the background every day. Was it an easy sell to bring these soap operas from radio to TV, where you had to sit and watch it each and every day to keep up?
No, it was a very difficult sell, actually. Most of the sponsors, companies like Procter & Gamble that had that owned these shows and that were paying for them to appear on radio, were really reluctant for exactly the reasons you say. They thought that women were not going to stop their housework and stare at the screen. Of course, the screens were very small in those days, and people believed when television started that you had to really concentrate to see the images and understand them. And so it took a while, and actually one of the creators of soap operas in radio, a woman named Erna Phillips, who actually has a Wisconsin connection. She spent some time at UW-Madison. She decided to pay for an experimental episode of one of the shows she'd created as a television episode. It was airing on radio, and she wanted to prove to Procter & Gamble that the show could work on TV. And so she paid for making an experimental TV episode, and they decided to give it a try. And so that helped to convince some of those sponsors to start putting these shows on TV. And it turned out audiences did want to watch and were more than happy to take a pause in their day and watch the television.
As I understand it, soap operas have generally been marketed toward women over the years, but were women prominent, as in that example you just gave, were women prominent behind the scenes as well?
Yes, absolutely. Soap operas are one of a really interesting genre of American broadcasting because women have always been so prominent in their creation. Erna Phillips, as I mentioned, is often considered the mother creator of the genre, and she was made many shows for radio and then transitioned and made many other shows for television, like As the World Turns and The Guiding Light. And she had proteges that she trained, some of whom were women, who went on to create their own programs. And of course, there's certainly lots of men in this history as well, but definitely on the creative side, there have been many prominent women.
Now, because this was a genre associated with women viewers and, as you say, women creators, you know, there's been a lot of parodies of soap operas. I think people have looked down on them in some ways as a form of entertainment. Is that, do you think, because it was viewed as women's entertainment in some way?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, we live in a culture, especially historically, where things that women were invested in and cared about were often denigrated and seen as kind of less than things that were more respected and respectable. Part of it was also, I think, how explicitly commercial they were, how they were so clearly initially about selling soap, that they were designed to draw people in so that they could be subject to the commercial messages. Now, that was really true of almost all of broadcasting, other than public broadcasting from the early days. But soap operas and their associations with women got some of that kind of negative heat and dismissiveness. Part of it also, I think, is because the storytelling was very could tend to be sort of melodramatic, where you had, you know, very improbable things happening. But that was really one strand of storytelling in the genre, even in the radio days, that didn't apply to all of the programs. And by television, by the time television came along, the genre became much more realist and not as kind of melodramatic, at least for a number of years.
Talking to Elena Levine from UW-Milwaukee, looking at soap operas, their history and their influence on American culture. I got to say, Elena, I did watch soap operas for a while in my youth, General Hospital mostly. Didn't think much of them. When I started working in broadcasting, I went back and thought, what a huge logistical challenge to write, produce, act out these dramas that aired for an hour every day. This is a huge challenge.
Absolutely. It's kind of one of the most amazing production feats of the broadcast industry, if you really think about it. And, you know, in the early days, 15 minutes a day on radio, that was relatively manageable because you had actors standing around a microphone, although there were scripts being written for every day. But in television, starts 15 minutes, expands pretty quickly to half hour, and then, as you say, becomes hour-long episodes, which happened in the 1970s. And, you know, there's still a number of these shows on air today, and they're producing an hour episode every day. It's quite amazing.
We're jumping past some history, but, you know, there was a heyday, it seemed like, in the 70s and 80s, and then there was a big shakeup, it seemed like, where soaps were threatened, some were canceled. Talk us through the fall and maybe rise again of some soap operas.
Sure. Yes, you're right. So the soaps really increase in their kind of power and their popularity and their kind of economic significance for the broadcast industry throughout the 60s, 70s, and most of the 80s. But then, as was true of most of broadcast network television, the ratings start to go down a bit. Advertisers are less willing to spend as much money to advertise their programs, and the audience starts to fall away. Now, there's lots of factors that contribute to this. Certainly, the rise of cable is really important initially, as audiences have more choices of what they can watch. And then, of course, a little bit later, the internet comes along and multiplies our choices even further. So there's those factors that play a part. Some people talk about women being more frequently in the workplace and not being home during the day to watch. I'm a little dubious about that claim because there were women watching these shows who were working in the 60s and 70s and 80s as well, using things like VCRs initially and then DVRs to time shift and keeping up other ways, watching on TV at work. So I'm not sure that women in the workplace is the main shift. I think it's more a kind of explosion of viewing options that people have had that have taken them away from that kind of daily habit. But yeah, the programs have, you know, were declining in popularity and in how much money they were making across the later 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. And then in the later 2000s, some of the broadcast networks started to realize that they weren't profiting at all from these programs anymore, and a number of long-running daytime soap operas were canceled. And then as of about 2012, there were only four such programs still on air, and that's still the situation we're in today.
Are those shows that are still on doing better now? Is there a resurgence, a renaissance?
I think in some ways there is. It's certainly nowhere near the heights that it was at in the early 80s, for example, when they were incredibly popular. But they're kind of maintaining. Their budgets have been cut, so they're producing shows at a much lower budget than they once were. And they have a number of really kind of inventive ways, I think, in which the creators have come up with to do that. But the budgets have been cut. But they are still making some money. Some of the programs are profitable because they are also sold internationally. And so they are doing okay in the U.S., but they're incredibly popular. There's a show, The Bold and the Beautiful, which is on CBS, which is incredibly popular internationally, gets big ratings in Europe. And so there's other ways in which these shows are finding to kind of keep afloat.
We're talking to Elena Levine right now, professor in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about soap operas in American culture, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a fan of soap operas? What is it about the stories and characters that kept or keep you watching day after day, year after year? Do you feel that those stories and formats are still relevant today? Or do you have a question for our guest about the history of soap operas? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Professor Elena Levine of UW-Milwaukee about the influence of soap operas on our culture and in how TV stories are told. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you a fan of soap operas? Do you think they've influenced American culture and entertainment? Do they deserve more respect than they're given sometimes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Valerie is with us in Muscadet. Valerie, hi.
Hi. Great topic. Thank you. I just wanted to say I'm 60, and I off and on, starting in college in the late 70s, started watching all my children. Back then it was a communal event. People would watch in the dorm on the communal floor where there would be one TV. And then, you know, I graduated, started working, and didn't watch it for a while. Then VCRs came out, just like your guest said, started taping it. And then also I'm a working artist, and there have been periods in my life when I've been able to paint full-time. And I would plan my painting day around my lunch break where I could get out of the studio and eat my soup and watch all my children. And I was just, you know, pretty crushed when it went away. It disrupted my whole daily routine. And then one more comment is that as far as social relevance, I can still to this day remember how amazing it was when it turned out that they were going to make Erica Kane's daughter Bianca be a lesbian.
Valerie, thank you so much for sharing that. A lot of ways we could go with that. Let's start with that connection or disconnect, maybe at different points, to social issues, Elena.
Yeah, well, All My Children is the best example of that, really. That and One Life to Live, which were two shows created by a woman named Agnes Nixon, who just passed away last year, who was a great innovator in this genre because she introduced these social issues to daytime soap opera storytelling in a way that people hadn't really seen previously. And so the example of Erica Kane's daughter, Bianca, coming out as a lesbian is a more recent example of the kinds of issues they did, but they were doing that kind of thing in 1971. That character Erica Kane actually had a legal abortion on television, arguably the first character to have a legal abortion on television. This was before Roe versus Wade, where abortion law varied by state. And so they tells a really fascinating story about the character's efforts to get an abortion at that time. And there's many other examples like that, stories about drug abuse, stories about racism, stories about the Vietnam War. All of these things were being dealt with on these shows in large part in that period in the late 60s and in the 1970s, but then that came back again in the 90s and 2000s with examples like Valerie was talking about.
Valerie, thanks for the call. Sorry you lost your show. We'll go next to Steve in Montreal. Steve, hi.
Yes, good afternoon.
What'd you want to tell us about, Steve?
Okay, hey. I was down on the Ohio River seeing my grandmother, And she was persuaded to curse this character who was on General Hospital. And I know she watched General Hospital. And then she looked at me, she said, "Stevie, I'm okay. It's just a soap opera."
Thank you so much, Steve, for sharing that story about your grandma. Yeah, people felt strongly about the characters, and there's definitely the characters people loved to hate and even curse at. Elena.
For sure. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, part of it is just seeing these people every day in your home where you usually would be watching this. And you really get to know the characters well. I mean, think about our relationships to characters in programs that don't air that frequently, you know, like on Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones or something like that. And that gets even more intensified on a daytime soap because you spend so much time with them. So that kind of reaction is really common.
And you mentioned, thanks a lot for that call, Steve, you mentioned things like Breaking Bad and so on. And it seemed like there's this gradual change in primetime TV where, okay, maybe they didn't become soap operas, but shows were willing to have narratives that you had to follow from one episode to the next. And it was this huge new innovative thing for a lot of TV, but soaps had been doing it forever.
Exactly. And there's been, you know, periods off and on throughout primetime television history where they've told those kinds of continuing stories, which are so typical now of a lot of the TV we watch. But in, you know, the 80s, that started with what were called the primetime soaps like Dallas and Dynasty and those kinds of shows. And then those died out and there would be, you know, a spattering of shows that were doing this kind of thing. But now we're definitely in an era of really deep investment in these continuing narratives, which differ from daytime soaps in many ways, but also are borrowing from a fundamental storytelling form that the soaps are really the ones that invented.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Josiah is with us, and Nina, hi.
Hi. I was wondering what exactly a soap opera is.
Oh, that's a great basic question. Yeah, they aren't as prominent as they once were. And also it can be hard, Elena, sometimes to pin down the border between soap opera and something kind of like a soap opera.
Exactly. Well, and I think that maybe the borders aren't as firm as we might imagine them to be. So usually, as I was saying earlier, the name came originally from the sponsors of these programs, which were soap companies selling dish soap and laundry soap and that kind of thing. And the opera part of it was meant to be a little bit disparaging originally, saying, oh, look how overly dramatic these programs are, as if they're something like an opera. But in fact, they're just trying to sell soap. So that was originally a very disparaging label. But over the years, the industry and the audience just sort of accepted it and said, okay, we're going to just call them that from now on. But some of the features that mark the genre, at least in its daytime form, are continuing stories that continue from episode to episode. There's no ending. The story just goes on every episode. They usually have a community of characters, a pretty large cast, and multiple storylines going on at once. Often the stories deal with personal life in some way, romances, family drama and family dynamics. Some soaps have introduced other kinds of plots like crime stories, mafia plots. There were brief periods in soap history that had more science fiction kinds of elements to them. So we've kind of seen it all. There's sort of no limit to what the stories are about. What defines them more is their daily airing and their continuing storytelling.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Elena Levine from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the past, present, and maybe future of the TV soap opera. Back to your calls now. Greg is with us in Oshkosh. Greg, hi.
Hi. Thank you. This is a fascinating topic.
Thanks.
I have an anecdote. I'm a little bit older than the time period you're talking about. I'm also 60, as one of the earlier callers was. But I remember with my friends playing in the summertime, doing outdoor activities, boy-type activities, baseball, football, camping, things like that. But we would all get together in the afternoon and watch Dark Shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason we were allowed to do that and felt like we could do that was because there were vampires.
Yep.
Greg, thank you so much for sharing that story. And yeah, Elena, Dark Shadows kind of started as a more normal soap. Do I have this right? And then vampires kind of segued in over time?
Yeah, it always was a little bit offbeat. It had a kind of gothic feel to it. It wasn't set in a sort of familiar, everyday American household like most of the soaps were. But within its first year on air, they decided they needed to do something to kind of make it a little more exciting and started to introduce these supernatural plots. And what hit really big was this vampire character named Barnabas Collins. And the audience went crazy for it, especially kids and young people in general who were, you know, watching the program often in the late afternoons after school or in the summer. And, you know, were just kind of amazed that this crazy stuff was going on TV.
Thanks, Greg, for sharing that story. We'll go next to Jean with us in Richland Center. Jean, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about, Jean?
I never got into the programs very much, but my mother lived with them for 15 minutes a day. Dad come home from work one day, and she was crying, and he said, "What in the world's the matter?" She said, "Penny died." And he said, "Who in the world is Penny?" But, "Oh, she's on as the world turns." And he said, "Oh, good grief."
Jean, thank you so much. I'm guessing, Elena, there are a lot of stories like that. And, okay, we can say, oh, it's kind of cheaply produced and, you know, the writing isn't always the greatest. But clearly, over time, people felt connections here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, probably the deepest, most, you know, heartfelt connections that you hear when people talk about their memories of, you know, consuming media are these stories from soap opera, just like that. And that, you know, it was really powerful to see a character that you knew their family, you knew so much about what had happened to them, and seeing them go through difficult times or die or things like that. Yeah, there's many, many stories like that. It's great to hear, you know, everyone has their own individual story, but together, it becomes a sort of broader cultural phenomenon.
Thanks a lot for that call. Very briefly, just a few moments left, Elena. Are we seeing new things coming along on Netflix or YouTube? Is somebody using high technology to take the place of soaps?
Well, interestingly enough, there's a kind of new little independent genre of what are sometimes called web soaps that initially began just airing on websites or on YouTube and have been picked up by streaming services like Amazon and Netflix. And these are shows often that have creators behind them who are people who had been involved with the broadcast television soaps, either actors or actresses who are wanting to try a new project or writers trying something new now that the broadcast industry has gotten smaller. And so there's this kind of interesting space where you see some potential for maybe this is going to turn into a new phenomenon in a new form as our ways of watching television evolve.
Elena, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Elena Levine is professor and director of graduate studies and the Media Studies MA in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at the UW-Milwaukee. She specializes in, among other things, daytime dramas, soap operas in American culture. You can still share your stories and memories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you're feeling less clever than usual today, it may be the weather's fault. As reported by NPR, a new Harvard study finds that trying to do brainy stuff like math tests can be more difficult when we're dealing with higher temperatures. Here's the basics of this study in a nutshell. Researchers gave daily math tests on an app to college students. Some of them lived in an air-conditioned dorm, some in a non-air-conditioned dorm. So we're talking some at 71 degrees, some at 80 degrees. Okay, so those are your two groups. The students in the hot dorm there, well, they did worse on these tests. They got more answers wrong, and they were slower. They took longer to do the tests. And there's some other research showing that office workers get less productive if the office is too warm. And I feel this, you know, over the last few days, much of Wisconsin has been pretty hot and humid. And I eat more and more every summer, kind of fold up when it gets too hot and don't want to get outside. But I'd want to have them test a counter theory. This is just one little study. If we just stopped doing the air conditioning and got used to that weather, or if I did that, maybe it wouldn't bother me so much. Maybe my brain power wouldn't be so, you know, tamped down by that hot, humid, annoying weather. So more research to do there. If you feel like, yeah, you don't function as well when it's too hot inside or out, send us a quick note. Email us ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.